This will be the final episode of Chewing On.
Oh my God. No, it won't.
I've got the sniffles.
Ending the show because you have a cold?
It's no, not ending the show. Well, the show will end, I hope, because my life is going to be over.
Oh my God. No, it won't.
I've got a terminal case of the sniffles. And nobody feels bad for me because it's not COVID, and you have to have COVID in order to get any sympathy these days.
You know, I got to say, what? I think that the sympathy for COVID is over.
We're
no
done
one
with
has
that?
Sympathy for COVID people.
Now it's kind of your own fault.
Well, I don't know about that, but it's more just like, yeah, okay, because we've all had it. So it's sort of like, yeah, been there, buddy.
Yeah.
Sucks. Best of luck.
My thing too now is one of my greatest passions prior to the scamdemic is I love coughing in public.
Mm.
Saddling up to a salad bar and just sure. fucking hacking all over that motherfucker.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. One you go greatest, under the sneeze guard.
I mean, just in the lettuce, just spitting on the olives. Now it's like every time in the past few days, because I have been sick, ladies and gentlemen. We were supposed to record this when, Liz?
Friday.
Yeah, and we did not because I had a fever.
You had the sniffles.
It was that was hard sniffles. I had sniffles and I was talking like this.
No.
But now it's like I go out in public and I'm like, fuck, man, like everyone's judging me for coughing and not wearing a mask.
Yeah. Well, you shouldn't do that. It's gross.
It's the new scarlet letter.
No, just don't cough on people. Just be normal.
Don't
be grossy.
People. I'm coughing on my nipple by unbuttoning half my shirt and putting my mouth in there.
Just don't be grossy.
Yeah. Here we are again.
Oh my God. I'll start it. Hello, everyone. Hello, hello, hello. Hello.
Hi, Liz.
Hello, I'm Liz.
By the time you're listening to this, I was Bray Spelden. I was a man who felt and thought and loved. And of course, we're joined by producer Young Chomsky.
And this is Chewing On. Hello, everyone.
Hello. You know, I don't want to snot all over the mic, Liz.
Well, yeah, I think you already have. We've been doing this for about an hour.
Yes.
And a half.
That's not true. Not an hour and a half. Oh, no, you're right. No, it's been an hour and a half. You know, we could do a long intro here where I complained and try to make people feel sorry for me.
Don't feel sorry for him. Don't ever feel sorry for him. He's fine.
You're fine.
Oh, you're a little sick? Oh, no, you got a cold. Oh, you got to take Mucinex? Oh, you're
well,
fine.
Well, no, I get to take Mucinex. I love it's fucking good. I drink Mucinex even when I'm not sick.
I don't like Mucinex because the name, grossy, it's grossy. And we already established during the cold open, don't be grossy.
Okay,
Mucinex, grossy name. Also in the commercials, it has the little grossy guy.
Yeah, that guy's cool, first of all.
No, he's grossy.
That guy's not grossy. First of all, you like guys like that.
No, I don't like guys like the Mucinex.
Yes, are you joking?
The slime ball?
How long have
he's
I
a
known
literal
you,
slime ball.
How long have I
like
known you?
Slime balls.
How long have I known you? First of all, he's not a slime ball. He's a ball of mucus. And second of all, you could do a lot. I'm sorry. When you blow your nose, you're like, oh, I've got so much slime coming out of me. No, you call it what it is, mucus. It's the scientific name for it. Second of all, first of all, I know all women basically want to fuck a variation of the Mucinex mucus. Second of all, I've known you for a long time, right? And I know a lot of the people that we both know. Mucinex.
I think this is wrong, but we should get into what the episode is really about, which is an interview with our old friend Ben Tarnoff. Let's get into it.
Beep boop 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 boop. Clickety clack, clickety clack, clickety clack. Hello.
Wait, you forgot the part that goes like dee doo.
Oh wait.
Dee, doo.
Oh, it sounds even worse now because I'm all fucked up and nasally.
Does that? Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds like what the goblin internet would sound like. Welcome. Welcome to True or Not. I'm going to go into a lower register here because of my new lifestyle of dying. Welcome to TrueAnon. We have with us here, taken from, I don't know, where do they do the internet? They have those large farms in like the middle of nowhere in Utah, found in the basement of one of those, shackled with wires and lines of code, zeros and ones written all over his body, like the Riddler suit of question marks. Ben Tarnoff, the co-founder of Logic Magazine, the magazine for nerds, and author of forthcoming Internet for the People, published next month out of the Verso Loft. We have Ben Tarnoff. Ben, I'm sorry. I said it, the magazine for nerds in reference to its name being Logic, but now that I realize what the – I mean, I already realized, but the fact that it's about computers, I guess that works on both levels.
No, that's accurate. Thank you for that introduction, Bryce. That was that was really something. But thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks for coming back on the show. It's been a minute. We were just saying it's been like 3 years, which is
2019.
Really nutty.
Last time we spoke, Dark of Not Marks. Much. That was a great title.
Yeah,
that was like our. I'm in my head. That was like our fifth episode. Although who knows? Maybe it was like our 20th or something.
But yeah,
that
I
was
have early. Absolutely no idea how to situate it. That's a good episode, actually. We're going to link to it in the notes for all the new listeners who haven't heard it. You should go back and listen to that. Before we kind of get into the meat and potatoes, I don't know why I'm saying that. I always go to that.
The zeros and ones, Liz. Before we get into the zeros and ones.
Of your forthcoming book, Internet for the People, I have just a fun little question. Because I don't think I've ever asked Brace this, and now this is a great opportunity to ask you this as well, because I'm just curious. What was your first experience with the internet?
Yeah, so I vividly remember this, actually. I just wrote about it recently. I was in the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, which is in Portland, Oregon. I was in Portland because my parents' friend was getting married. So I was walking around this museum, which is awesome, by the way, if folks ever go to Portland, called OMSI. And I was looking for like space shuttles, rockets. I was into astronauts. I was
been like 10 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was looking for something like really like big. You know, you have like all of these like really huge astronaut things at those space museums. And we stumbled across the computer room. And we walked in and there were a bunch of, you know, like ancient, by our standards, IBM PCs in a row, and they were connected to the internet. This would have been 94, actually. So really early days, before actually the privatization of the physical infrastructure of the internet. So at this point, the internet is technically under the leadership of the National Science Foundation, a federal agency. And it's obviously very, very primitive by today's standards. You know, you don't have modern search engines. You have Yahoo, if you guys remember that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I still use Yahoo.
Yahoo Mail is actually still pretty popular, believe it or not.
Yeah,
and groups, right? Or did they shut down groups. Yahoo groups?
Yeah, I think they
that's
did
early
shut that
fantasy
down.
Betting stuff kind of all originated in Yahoo groups, which we can talk about.
No, Yahoo had real staying power, but you know, as you guys remember, Yahoo wasn't really even a search engine. It was like a handmade directory. They actually like paid people to like create this like directory of the internet, which sounds so like archaic now, but you know, that was actually the best thing available. But I remember sitting down on one of these computers and like looking for stuff about Star Trek, right? Because I was a nerd, as Brace mentioned, and I was just blown away. Style. So much information about like the USS Enterprise, about how big it was, how many, you know, floors it had and all sorts of things. And I was, it was exhilarating. And it's like, I never been able to recapture that high. You know, I've been kind of chasing that dragon ever since, but that was the best experience of the internet was my first.
I remember my friend Gordon showed me porno at his house.
That was your first internet experience?
Yeah, yeah. And it made me feel uncomfortable. But not even like, because I had never seen like none of that stuff before. But I was just like, I know this is weird that we're looking at this together in your living room.
Oh my God. I think that my dad was like an early computer guy. And I think that I can't remember exactly like my first experience. Because I feel like I vividly remember using AOL Messenger like constantly,
yeah,
and that being a really big thing. But I remember my dad showing my mom the internet and being like, check this out. My mom being like really unimpressed because he was just like, look, the White House has a webpage. And she's like, who cares? Which, you know, I guess he won that conversation in the end. So your book, Internet for the People, is kind of a history of this thing that we call the internet. I kind of want to say this thing we call the internet because that term kind of encapsulates a lot of things, especially now that we all have pocket computers always on us at every moment. But your book is divided into basically like two parts. You kind of section it off in this history. And you have this section that's called the pipes and this section called the platforms. I hope, by the way, that's not a spoil. That's not really like a spoiler, but just in case.
I don't think nonfiction books have spoilers.
Maybe they should.
Yeah, true.
So we spent a good deal of time the last time you were on the show talking about kind of the history of the pipes, the infrastructure, the kind of build out of early internet architecture, kind of ARPANET and DoD and the state kind of partnering and funding a lot of that work and build out and how that kind of came into existence. And so I kind of want to maybe, Brace and I were talking about that, maybe we could focus our discussion today on kind of what the second half of the book is about, where you really focus on the history of what you call the platforms. And we can maybe discuss what you mean by that, and why you think that's kind of a troubling or difficult term. But that build out kind of began, let's say, in like the mid to late 90s. Maybe there's this like first wave of platform tech, kind of like, you know, you have the tech crash in the 2000s or in the early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s. That's kind of this like crisis bloodletting between like dev pushes kind of for what this will end up being. And so you start your story with this little company called AuctionWeb, which later becomes eBay. The founder of which, Pierre Omidyar, patron of this podcast, he's kind of this archetype for the libertarian kind of anarcho-capitalist visionary guy that comes to kind of shape the way that we utilize the internet today, or how we kind of enter into this thing that we call the internet. So I thought that maybe we could kind of start there with AuctionWeb. Kind of maybe you could explain why eBay or AuctionWeb, like why you think that company in particular is so vital for understanding how the internet today came into being.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so the story here begins in 1995. And so that's a year after I first used the internet at that museum in Portland. And in 1995, a number of important things happen. In April 1995, the National Science Foundation, which, as I mentioned, up until that point had basically had the leadership over the internet as a federal agency, terminates its backbone, its kind of core artery of the internet in April 1995, and the private sector takes over. So that's kind of the moment in which the pipes, you know, as you're talking about the pipes, it's moment at which the pipes are privatized. Now, the question going forward is how to make money from what people do on the internet. Right. So once you privatize the pipes, you can make money by selling people access to the internet. Right. We think about this today, like Comcast, an internet service provider, pay a monthly fee to get online. But the real profit potential of the internet, as people understood at the time, wasn't about monetizing access. It was about monetizing activity, which is to say you had to figure out a way to make money, not from getting people online, but from what they did once they got there. Now, the problem is that there wasn't all that much to do once you got online, right? As I'm sure you guys recall, using the internet in the mid-90s, it kind of sucks. I mean, we could be nostalgic for it today, but you know, the web is still in its early days. It's kind of barely usable. It's fairly primitive. There isn't a whole lot going on.
It's interesting because at this point, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I know you're like a scholar of this stuff, but I feel like a lot of early social activity was kind of happening on the internet in terms of like bulletin boards and like kind of smaller little group things. You mentioned Star Trek stuff, like that was all these kind of little niche communities were popping up, some of which I think were actually kind of connected to some of the academics that were kind of working on early internet stuff out of the universities, because they were all kind of like dorks basically fighting these little groups, but that like there's no like entry way into that. It's like you had to kind of like find out about it word of mouth, right? So like you're saying, there's no real like, there was no way to kind of get into any of that stuff. There was no there was not a lot of entry points.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Liz. And I think as you indicate, it tends to attract a more technical crowd because to get online and to be online in those days, you had to have like some technical competency. Like if you wanted to use Usenet, if you wanted to use a BBS, if you wanted to use Gopher, these like early ways BBS. Of being online, you had to have usually some degree of technical skill. And those subcultures, as you put it, that develop, you know, often have their roots in, you know, computer scientists, kind of these nerd fan cultures and so on. So, you know, the arrival of the World Wide Web in the early 90s, and specifically the arrival of a graphical web browser, the kind of point and click ability, which we take for granted today, that was a huge innovation. And that enabled people to come online who wouldn't have had the technical savvy to get online in an earlier era. Now, as I said, there wasn't a whole lot for them to do on the web, but it gave them an entry point to a kind of more visual, richer experience, and they didn't have to have quite as much technical skill to do so.
Okay, so back to eBay. I'm sorry, I interrupted because I was just curious about that kind of social component. And I think we might return to some of those ideas when we talk about development of like social apps and social media. But let's get back to, I keep calling it eBay, but AuctionWeb, eBay, same company. You were talking about how they, you know, the real money to be made on the internet, like you said, was not monetizing access, but monetizing activity. And Omidyar kind of had this vision of creating just like, I don't know how else to put it, but like an ANCAP commodity exchange with like no rules. That it would all be kind of like free market individuals and this kind of like perfect Hayekian like universe of equal market actors all kind of haggling and figuring out prices for goods in this kind of utopian libertarian space online.
Well, I'm glad we took the detour into the social nature of the internet, Liz, because it actually sets up the story of AuctionWeb perfectly. So AuctionWeb, as you said, was what eBay was called before it was called eBay. Pierre Omidyar, who, for folks who don't know, is a French-Iranian programmer and entrepreneur, builds AuctionWeb basically as a side project, one weekend, Labor Day weekend in 1995. And as I mentioned earlier, 1995 is the year when everything is popping off, when the dot-com bubble is starting to inflate. So 95 is the same year of the Netscape IPO, Netscape, of course, being the company that has the first really popular graphical web browser.
The Navigator itself.
Exactly, Netscape Navigator, which has a real run and then kind of crashes out towards the end of the decade. And this is also the year in which Amazon.com opens its online storefront. So the web economy is starting to heat up. And in the midst of this, Omidyar starts this site, which, as you said, Liz, is a site where people can come together to buy and sell things on the web, in particular through this auction model that, of course, we now associate with modern eBay. He was coming to it from a place of libertarian politics and believed that this market would be essentially self-organizing, that if you put people together in the right way, if you gave them a bulletin board to leave reviews for one another, if everyone had perfect information at all times, which is, you know, kind of in the neoclassical view, the theory of a perfect market, then everything would simply work. And what he finds, as you might imagine, over the course of running this site, is that they actually don't work perfectly without supervision. That in fact,
yeah, it's a funny thing about markets. Yeah.
Yeah, the funny thing about markets is they need states, actually.
Right.
You know, markets are figments of politics. They're created and sustained by states. So Omidyar, through the course of running this site, discovers that he has to implement a kind of sovereignty in order to supervise and govern interactions on the site. But the really important story here, the kind of main takeaway and the crux of my argument in the book is that what Omidyar stumbles upon in AuctionWeb is a kind of proto-platform. I don't love the word platform, as you mentioned, Liz, and we could talk about some of the limitations of that term. But what Omidyar ends up doing as early as 1995 is almost kind of on accident, discovering the core elements that would be the basis of the very lucrative business models of these later leviathans of the internet, like Google, Facebook, and Amazon. And crucially, he does so by applying that social nature of the internet that you were talking about before, Liz, like its capacity to bring people together. It's how people can communicate through email, through Usenet, through BBSs. He takes that social nature of the internet and fuses it with the market. He unlocks the commercial potential of it. And that's really his major innovation. And eBay, not coincidentally, is wildly profitable from the beginning. This is the dot-com boom when, you know, you have pets.com, companies that are just hemorrhaging money, right? You can go on YouTube and see the pets.com Super Bowl commercial where they're just, you know, just burning money, basically. eBay is minting money. So it's a bit of an outlier in this respect. And Omidyar kind of discovers the basic ingredients of how to make money on the web, which is an important discovery.
It's interesting. I just noticed with your use of the word mint and Leviathan that it seems like you and obviously, clearly, with your use of the word sovereignty, which is very deliberate, but it seems like you're making the connection that these companies, Amazon, Google, eBay, in this case, I'm sure maybe you would add a couple more in this, that you're comparing them to states, actually, the actual like how states function. Do you think that these companies are like states, or is that, do you think that comparison makes sense?
I think it does. You know, there's a scholar named Frank Pascal who has this term functional sovereignty, where he makes this argument very explicitly that these big platforms, we should really think of them as states and state-like as much as market actors, because really they create markets. You know, they don't so much participate in markets as make and create the kind of rules around markets. So I think it's an interesting question. I wouldn't say I have like the kind of deep interest or training in political science to take a strong view of that argument. But I think it's certainly true when we look at the kind of more narrow cases of eBay and a number of these other companies that later apply those patterns to great effect, like Google, that they are forced to exercise something like state sovereignty in order to make money, right? I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, that's why someone like Omidyar has to develop a state-like apparatus. It's actually to keep the profit machine moving.
Yeah, I would say that not only do they have to sort of exercise the sovereignty in order to create these markets and to make money, but also to avoid regulation, or at least over-regulation in their viewpoint, from actual governments and nations. I mean, I think a lot of the reason that we see a lot of the policies that we do see from especially social media platforms is they're trying to get ahead of any potential legislation from whatever, usually the American government, by trying to kind of like cut off any areas of critique or to, already take on board what they anticipate will be laws that might be passed by the government in order to do it their own way.
You mentioned, Ben, that that you had problems with the term platform, and you spend a good amount of time in your book discussing that. Maybe we can get into that here. What do you see is the problem with the kind of the use of the word platform, or maybe the like what's so imprecise about our kind of describing these companies or these sort of, I don't know how else to describe them, these platforms as platforms?
I feel I should make the case for why I'm being so pedantic about this as well, which is that I think that the metaphors we use to think about the internet really matter.
Yeah.
You know, the internet is very difficult to visualize. You can't really think about it in a very coherent way. It's like, you know, if you Google image search the internet, you get a bunch of like strange kind of glowing spinning orbs. Like it's the internet is very complex. It exists at a number of different scales. And obviously it's very important for our everyday lives and for our society. So the metaphors that we use to think about the internet have a lot of downstream consequences. And one of the unfortunate things is that much of our discourse about the internet and how the internet works is taken from the companies who control it. Facebook, Google, and so on, they talk about themselves as platforms, and that's why we call them platforms, right? So to some extent, we're operating on enemy territory here. Now, why are those terms so strategic for those companies? Why do they want to think of themselves and present themselves as platforms? Well, because platform suggests a certain amount of openness, neutrality, kind of levelness, if you think about a train platform. This is an argument that the scholar Tarleton Gillespie makes in particular, that the platform metaphor does a lot of work for these companies, that they don't want to appear as sovereigns. They don't want to appear to be actively ordering how our online spaces function. They want to present themselves as existing just in the background, that you're just using them as a platform. Now, of course, platform has a specific technical meaning, which is a set of components like APIs that a developer could build an application on top of. But what platform has come to mean as it's been deployed in this broader sense by these companies are really this set of complex computational systems that organize our online life. So in my view, it's an obfuscation, it's a mystification, and I have a proposal for a better term to think about these systems, which I think are more like shopping malls than anything else. So in the book, I make this case for thinking of these systems as online malls, as basically these corporate enclosures where a bunch of transactions are taking place inside of them, and they found a way to draw value, to make money from all those transactions. But the shopping mall is really the paradigm here.
And you actually borrowed that term from Jason Sadowski, right? He's actually been on our show too. We talked to him about 5G. A bunch of people got mad at us for talking about 5G at the time. I still think that was a good episode. But yeah, you say that they look, that it's like easier to think of them as shopping malls, that you kind of like enter in and they are the kind of, I don't know what to say, like, I mean, it's incorrect to say landlord, right? But the owner of this kind of space where all these kind of stalls are opened up. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. So you mentioned Jathan Sadowski's work here. And the point that Jathan makes in the paper that I draw from is that if you think about a shopping mall is basically in the business of taking rents, right? As you said, Liz, you have stalls, you have different shops, and to be in the shopping mall, they have to pay rent, right? If you think about the online counterpart of a shopping mall, if you think about a Google or a Facebook as an online mall, which again is this corporate enclosure where all sorts of transactions are taking place inside, some of them buying and selling, some of them social, right? Because you go to the shopping mall also to socialize with your friends if you're a suburban teenager. So you're in the shopping mall. You're in the shopping mall, and the way that the owner of a shopping mall is making money from you doing all of these things within the walls of this corporate enclosure is by extracting rents. Now, as Jathan points out in his piece, they're not just extracting monetary rents in the online mall. So as a monetary rent, think about something like Uber, right? Uber is taking a commission on each of your rides. That would be an example of a monetary rent. But Jathan explains that they're also extracting data rents, right? Because of course, that same Uber ride, they're manufacturing an enormous amount of data about your ride, right? Just as Google is manufacturing an enormous amount of data about your interactions with Google and all of the many online properties in which Google's software is embedded. So these data rents, in fact, become very important to the business model because they can be monetized in a number of different ways. In the mainstream conversation, we're particularly familiar with how data is monetized to sell targeted advertising because that's the basis of, you know, Google and Facebook's business model in particular. But they can be monetized in all sorts of different ways to optimize certain business processes. You know, there's all sorts of ways that data can be made valuable. And also from a financial perspective, maybe even more importantly, the perception that data is valuable is what drives the share price of these companies, right? If you think about a company like Uber, much of the share price, I guess until recently, was sustained in this idea that, well, this huge treasure trove of data and their capacity to keep manufacturing so much data must mean that they can gain some type of competitive advantage. So it's also the investor's faith in data that makes it valuable.
Yeah, but I mean, it's been shown that like a ton of the data that a lot of these companies collect is basically junk, right?
Yeah. And, you know, Tim Wang has this wonderful book called Subprime Attention Crisis, where he kind of frontally takes on the advertising business on the internet and says essentially what you're saying, Brace, which is, you know, a lot of these ads, they don't even get to real humans. You know, there's a lot of bots. A lot of this stuff is junk. I mean, the world of online advertising is also extremely opaque. You know, it's black boxes within black boxes within black boxes. It's very scammy. And, you know, there's a good chance, as Tim argues in his book, that very little of this online, like digital ad spend actually makes it to the end consumer. So there's a lot of nonsense here. But, you know, importantly, data is still being manufactured, whether or not it can actually be put to good use. And also importantly, so long as investors think it's valuable, it is, right? I mean, a lot of this is kind of sustaining this faith that if you just create lots and lots of data, you can have a profitable business.
So I have a question, because I feel like I almost want to like push this shopping mall thing a little bit further, if you'll like, I don't know, allow me a little indulgence here. Like, I feel like, and again, please interrupt and correct me if I'm wrong, because a lot of this technical stuff I don't fully, totally understand. But in the 2000s, you know, in order to build a kind of software application, you would have, at that point, needed your own servers. You would need to build out your own payment system. You would need to code the thing kind of like from front to back, you know, optimize the backend architecture, all that kind of stuff. Like, you would basically have to build from the bottom up. And now, kind of, you know, and you talk about this in your book, but it's even more so, especially with the kind of, I don't know, third wave of kind of, you know, digital development, if we want to talk about mobile, that everything is really plug and play now, right? That like, basically, anyone can build anything through APIs and services. You have Amazon Web Services, Stripe, Shopify, Unity, Twilio, like all those kind of companies that basically everyone is kind of building on the same, like off of, and just like baking, building different shapes
it's
out
like
of all the same Legos.
It's like putting modules together. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, it's like an important detail that, I mean, I think that it's, you know, it's not even that you don't need to know how to code, but that the places and uses for one to start to even have to write differentiated code are basically shrinking as we move forward with this technology. That basically we're hitting a kind of like ceiling on where stuff can go. And so in this market, then differentiation can only come from, if it can't come from the underlying infrastructure, right? It has to come from somewhere else, which is like the brand, the design, the marketing, positioning, all this kind of like front end stuff. But it's not coming from the technology, right? And so if there isn't much to be kind of invented or developed software-wise to drive profits, like this is what's driven everything into optimization, into attention, eyes, gamification, user growth is just competing for time. And so when everything is basically identical, you can only optimize around attention, which means that now we're reaching a point in, you know, I would say in like web development and tech development that, and you see this with companies like OnlyFans and Patreon and all these kind of like next gen marketplaces, right? Kind of building off of actually what AuctionWeb really pioneered. But that there's just like a global race to snatch profits as quickly as possible through like commodity and labor arbitrage, basically, because there's like no other places to squeeze anything because everything is so identical. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, Liz. I mean, there's so many developments, I think, behind the forces that you're describing. I mean, you know, one that stands out, of course, is just how intensely concentrated the internet industry has become, or at least comparatively more concentrated now than it certainly was in the 90s. You know, if you think about these leviathans of the modern internet, like Google and Facebook and Amazon and others, you know, one of the things that they do is they acquire startups, right? You know, to get talent, to get technology, sometimes just to forestall competition. So there's also, you know, the ecosystem, to use a horrible, inevitable word, has also just changed a lot because you have these super predators that are just gobbling up a lot of smaller companies that in a previous era would have evolved into a bigger company or a medium-sized company, but there's kind of less oxygen available now for that kind of broader environment to develop. I mean, people still start startups, and there's still like a lot of, you know, I'm sure you guys have talked about Web3, but like Web3 is kind of like a paradigm of the kind that you're describing that a lot of people have put their faith in precisely because they see it as an opportunity to restore some of the kind of technical dynamism of the kind that, you know, inevitably declines in a more homogenized web that's controlled by a few players.
Yeah, that's actually something I was thinking about when reading your book, is that, you know, you talk a lot about how decentralization would be a possible, future for a more decommercialized internet. One of the big buzzwords amongst Web3 people is decentralization. Now, I don't always know what they mean when they talk about that. I think a lot of times when Web3 people talk, they kind of just like just say whatever word. I mean, I get this. I do this too. You kind of just say words sometimes when you're talking to people. Sometimes if you use bigger words, people will be like, okay, yeah, oh, that's smart or something, you know? And, you know, decentralization, what else do they do? Crypto, I don't even really know what that means to begin with, but I've been saying it, you know, basically every day to any woman that'll talk to me for years. But you know, how do you sort of view the, you know, people obviously, you know, they're calling it Web3. It's the future of the web. You know, how do you view that kind of playing into the thesis of your book?
Decentralization is a funny word because it obviously means different things to different people. And I think we need to start from a charitable point, which is the reason that the word decentralization does speak to a wide audience is because many people feel that something has gone wrong with the internet. And that's a correct perception. So I think we need to meet people where they are there and say, yeah, you're right. Something has gone wrong with the internet. Now, I'm not sure that Web3 is the solution to that. I mean, Web3 is essentially a branding campaign by the venture capitalist firm Andreessen Horowitz, yeah. which is an attempt to—
Friend of the show.
Yeah,
Brenda, I'm sure a patron.
Yeah,
I mean Andreessen comes up in the book because he's such literally a patron.
No, he pays for the pedophile tier.
Oh.
I don't think he listens to the podcast.
You'll be hearing from his lawyers,
yeah.
Bryce.
I am sure. One of his lawyers.
Future mayor of San Francisco, right? Yeah. Or just maybe he's mayor behind the scenes.
I would love for Wile E. Coyote to stop inflating that guy with the fucking bicycle pump in his mouth every night. That would be it's abuse.
Yeah, he ate Web 2 and Web 1.
Right, because he was a figure in Web 1, of course. I mean, we talked about Netscape, was an important figure in Web 2 and is now, you know, one of the handful of folks who is trying to create this Web 3 paradigm. And Web 3, you know, we don't need to go too deep on it, but Web 3 is essentially a bid to take blockchain-based technologies and make them woven into the architecture of the internet. And it's ill-defined, I think, Bryce, as you point out, because it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people and kind of shoots out a number of different directions. But I think in general, it's an attempt to financialize, to securitize more of our online experience by taking an abstraction called a token and making it the kind of basis for all sorts of interactions that you might have on the internet. In my view, it's really a kind of either deeper or kind of lateral commercialization. It's a further commercialization of the internet, not a decommercialization, a deprivatization, which is what I'd like to see more of. But, you know, this is a good point, which is I have a lot of sympathy for more decentralized approaches in the book, but I also think we need to be very wary of the different ways that the word is deployed and by whom is it deployed, what politics attends those deployments, and also not to make a fetish of decentralization or the local or the community, right? Because those have their own severe limitations. And also because when we think about the internet, you can never have a fully decentralized internet. It's always a question of what do you want to centralize and what do you want to decentralize? It's not we want a centralized internet, we want a decentralized internet. So it's always a set of trade-offs. And because the internet exists at so many different scales and consists of so many different technologies, you're not going to be able to decentralize it entirely. But of course, that's not really what the Web3 folks mean when they say decentralization.
I think your point about it being this deeper commercialization is really important. When I was reading your book, and particularly, I mean, not to keep focusing on it, but particularly the section about AuctionWeb, I was reminded of a company that I think actually even started before AuctionWeb, though you would know better than I would, which was E-Trade. And that E-Trade pretty much set the terms for web-based trading, like actual stock trading, basically up until another friend of the show, Robinhood, was launched in 2013, which really mm-hmm. like changed the game, I think, in ways that are still not fully appreciated. But really, Robinhood, which we've done a whole episode on actually with GameStop and all of that, is just like a pocket casino, like doling out crack. I mean, just really took, principles of gamification to this like other level that I think like the most garish level they could mm-hmm. and then waited to see who would like kind of roll them back. You know what I mean? It was just like really just horrifically impressive in like a villainous way. And it, you know, that's a company that makes money on every trade as opposed to how much every trade makes, which was how a typical brokerage firm operates. And so they were able to really kind of shift the game on where companies were extracting profits and at what point in the kind of transaction between the user and the service. And I think that what they pioneered, you see it being repeated over and over again as just the, you know, again, the gamification, the gamblification of like mm-hmm. almost every kind of now new like web service or website. But Web3 really, like, you know, Web3 with all of the crypto exchanges, I mean, FTX calls it like the everything exchange, right? Like they have really taken this to a deeper level, where if you think of AuctionWeb and eBay as this kind of commodity exchange, where it was just this sort of like basic market structure, then Web3 is taking that market structure and now creating, I mean, this is not a new point or whatever, but it's the deeper commodity because it's the derivatives market now that's being entered into the web, right? And now you're finding derivatives of derivatives being created in new marketplaces all over. I guess that's the next stack or whatever that people call it.
Yeah, interestingly, Web3, as you know, Liz, is often presented as a solution for creators. I kind of hate this term, but...
Yeah, I hate that term too. I think that's us. We're creators.
You guys are creators, I was going to say. Mm-hmm. I think you would qualify. But, you know...
I'm a creative.
But as speaking to this very real crisis, right, which is the thing, like for Web3 to get wider traction beyond just the venture capitalists who would benefit from it, it does have to speak to some real sense of a problem. And of course, there is a problem, which is, you know, creative people can't get compensated because of the internet. I mean, the internet has made it harder for people to make a living from writing, for instance, famously, you know, for decades at this point. So Web3 is often presented by its proponents as a way to, through this tokenization of everything, more fairly compensate people for their mm-hmm. labor. So there is, you know, a kind of almost egalitarian rhetoric that one hears, which again, I think is also meant to be a bit nostalgic. I mean, I think part of the reason Web3 also appeals to that generation, actually, of folks like Andreessen, is because it reminds them of the kind of headier days of early Web1 too. So it's a kind of return to the frontier, so to speak, as well.
I'm just imagining right now somebody making a living off Substack speculation. In a few years, just like trading NFTs of like who, you know,
that's the direction we're going in. I was just reading on Bloomberg, there's this new thing that was just approved, Kalshi. Did you hear about this? Uh-uh. That these markets they've tried doing this, but it's basically a stock market for anything. And it's funny because, you know, they have like predict it in those kind of yes, no markets, but they aren't really, the CFTC, they finally approved this like new betting market that you can just place bets on anything and everything. And there's a quote in the piece actually that I wrote down because it started to like fuck with my head, where it said the size of these markets had been limited because regulators worried that Wall Street scale trading could create incentives for investors to meddle with reality. Which is such a, my favorite thing that I've talked about it bunch of times on the show, definitely when we talked about Tesla and that kind of upending of the options in the equity markets, but like when the tail starts wagging the dog, right? Where suddenly these online marketplaces that, as you lay out, really, I mean, this is like the foundation of so much of what the internet as we experience it now was built on, these early marketplaces and Amazon and Google in its own way, and particularly AuctionWeb and eBay, like has now kind of deepened its, you know, its tentacles are like deeper and deeper and wider and wider. And now it's kind of like, you know, it's a real question of how these markets are now going to start shaping the world that we like to pretend is completely distinct and separate from the one that we experience digitally, right? So I think before we wrap up, I want to kind of like bring us back to some of the little social stuff that we were talking about at the beginning, because that's like on our show, Brace and I, our hobby horse, we love talking about social media. We talk about it too much. People get mad at us. But, you know, I think it's a really interesting question. And, you know, you spend a good amount of your time in your book talking particularly about Facebook. And the question of scale, you know, is very interesting when we talk about social media communities. You know, I think it's interesting. I think you write in your book, instead of Facebook, imagine millions of social media communities, each with their own rules and customs and cultures. These communities would be plural in purpose. They would host different kinds of interactions. And it's interesting because I do think that that was kind of, like we mentioned with the bulletin boards and all the kind of early web, that was like everyone's sort of initial impulse for the way that they wanted to kind of, you know, spontaneously organize on the internet, right? And now we're in this moment that everyone loves to call like the tech lash or whatever, which is fine, I think, but that there seems to be a bit of that same sort of like drawing back away from these very large scale social media platforms, sorry to use that word for lack of a better term, but that is also like, again, it's kind of happening organically. You're seeing a lot of like the kind of return of really exclusive like group chats and group DMs being really important in a variety of ways and being quite influential in a lot of different pipelines, Discord being extremely important and popular, or, you know, Twitch communities and all of these different sort of like smaller niche groups kind of organizing in much smaller. And we should also say then, because smaller, they're more hidden. There's like a lot less transparency about what's being said. A lot
of weird stuff happening in them.
A lot of weird stuff. Yeah, totally. I mean, that's the trade-off, right? But so I'm curious about, this is always that tension, you know, of the kind of the openness, the broadness, the kind of vast totalizing public square versus these kind of smaller, more intimate communities. And kind of, I don't know, just your thoughts there on what we're going to fucking do with this thing that's called social media.
It's a really interesting development, like the rise of Discord and the kind of return to these more private spaces. And I think it makes a lot of sense, which is like, you know, Facebook is basically completely unusable. I still have a fondness for Twitter, but it's often unusable. I mean, these big public platforms have become overrun with a lot of nonsense, honestly, and it doesn't seem like they're getting any better. So I definitely understand the impulse to, you know, create these more private online communities, which, as you point out, Liz, are a lot more like what the early internet looked like.
Yeah.
And I think there's a potential and a promise there of a more heterogeneous internet. I mean, part of what happens when you have this very monopolistic structure of the platforms is something that looks a lot like gentrification, frankly, this kind of flattening where everything really starts to look the same. And so I have a lot of faith in a more, you know, a kind of more polycentric online experience where people can create communities that really don't look like one another. Now, I should say, I don't think that we have to choose here between something that's, you know, very private and closed and something that's very public and open. We actually have the technology to synthesize the too, through open protocols, through the concept of federation. And this is actually a concept that the internet itself is built on, because the internet is essentially a language that makes it possible for very different networks to interconnect, to form a network of networks. So those networks can be constructed in a variety of different ways, but they can all communicate with one another. And we can actually apply that same principle to social media. And there's a lot of interesting experiments in the decentralized web community around this. But you can apply this principle of federation so that you can have your small community of social media folks who are making governance choices together, making, you know, democratic decisions around content moderation, around how you're going to not just moderate information, but, you know, what kind of information is going to exist in that space, how you're going to enrich that conversation. But that doesn't have to be isolated. Through open protocols, that community can interoperate with a number of others. So there are actually existing projects that are already starting to do this. So I think that's an important point, which is actually we can kind of have it both ways. It's not to say there aren't difficulties and trade-offs involved. Content moderation is actually this very, very difficult thing. That's mm-hmm. a hard thing to do well, and, you know, is going to depend a lot on people's values that are going to vary. But when it comes to, you know, local, private, small, or big, public, global, we have the technology to stitch those together, actually.
Well, I have one last question, and it's also about social media as well, and really just kind of about the internet in general, but I think social media in particular is, you know, it occurred to me, and this has actually occurred to me for quite a while, but it reoccurs to me every so often, especially when I'm reading about this stuff, and it reoccurred to me when I was reading your book. You know, does it ever really strike you sometimes, or do you ever wonder, what if mankind was like not meant to communicate this way? Like, what if this like barrage of like information, you know, oftentimes contextless information, or at least information that's like totally shorn from any like from the real world, you know, you're just getting it through like a screen or something, or, you know, this like weird mediated interaction with others, like you know, I think a lot of the kind of ills of the internet, or that have been born from the internet, are often ascribed to this being sort of like growing pains, or, you know, like something similar to like, you know, how things were with the beginning of the printing press. But you know, it strikes me as like, what if the whole idea of us like communicating, you know, via these digital means, it's just like not something that the human brain and the human soul really is meant to be doing.
That's a fair question, Brace. And I don't mean to sound too optimistic about our ability to make a better internet. Maybe the internet shouldn't exist in the first place. I'm actually totally open to that possibility. I think what's hard is that, you know, as soon as the internet emerges, people mm-hmm. start using it to communicate. It's actually not what it was created for, but it's what people end up using it for. Email becomes, you know, wildly popular on the early internet because people love to communicate. They love to socialize. And this, I think, does, you know, without sounding like one of those guys, I think that does speak to something in our human nature. I don't love the term, but I think to the extent that we have any human nature, we are a social species. You know, we do need to be around one another. We need to form communities with one another. And we live in a very isolated and isolating society. You know, people are like really quite alienated and lonely. It's not a new observation. So I think that there is something tragic here, which is that these technologies speak to some degree exploit our need to connect with one another. And the lack of outlets for doing so in real life. I mean, our kind of social fabric has really hollowed out. Mm-hmm. You know, people don't have unions. They don't have like civil organizations. They don't have like neighborhood organizations where they can connect in, you know, some of them do. But, you know, there has been this like real loss of people's like kind of rich civic life that I think social media in particular takes advantage of. You know, it takes advantage of people's desire to connect and provides this substitute, which, you know, in many cases can be frankly toxic, can make people feel worse, you know, can make people feel more isolated. In terms of what is to be done, I think, you know, that's why I'm curious about the idea of developing a social media paradigm that actually brings people into space offline as well. One of the virtues of having a more place-based, community-based social media site is that these governance choices about how you're going to run your social media community could be actually face-to-face. And I'm a big believer in face-to-face deliberation as the only way that you can kind of get a democratic process. So I think if we could build an internet that forced us offline as well, that didn't try to subsume all forms of human experience into the internet, then I think we might be a bit closer to the solution. But it's possible that we should just tear it up at the roots. I'm open to that.
I actually have a midway solution there. Is I think we should just make the internet significantly slower, like mid-90s level speeds.
Bring back the sounds. Bring back the wee-woo. Then people are going to be like, all right, that's enough. It's too annoying. Too annoying to do this.
I had read it. I'd read this other book about the, I think they got Richard Seymour's book about the I think social media in particular. And there's one line he has in there about, and you know, you spend 400,000 hours of your life awake on average. And I think that reminded me, of course, of like the screen time, little notifications that you can get on your iPhone. And like, in particular when I'm using my phone a bunch, you know, usually for stuff related to the show, but it's like, I'll get this like little notification of like, you spent this much more time on the internet than last time. And you're just like calculating those hours all together. And it's just so much, I don't know. It's like this time dissolving that you totally can never get back.
And the fact that the internet is mobile is also a big change from the 90s, right? Yeah. It's not just that it's faster. You can take it anywhere. It fits in your pocket. And that's like such a huge thing for the internet to be kind of untethered. For it to be just kind of like, and with Internet of Things, of course, it's like can be woven into the walls, right? It's absolutely everywhere. So I think there is a really interesting conversation to be had about like, you know, what should the social limits, you know, kind of agreed upon limits to the internet or computing more broadly be? Obviously, in a profit-driven system, you can't have those types of decisions because it always has to be more, more, more. But I think that's a really important conversation to have.
I will say, I do think that the People's Republic of China, I know they made a law limiting young people's online gaming. And I think that, you know, our progressive lawmakers in this country could possibly take that law and really just go wild with it.
They would like, if the US would like fucking mandate gaming. You know what I mean? Like, we're just such backwards people.
Nation of Elden Lords.
Yes. Yeah.
Ben, thank you so much. The book is called Internet for the People. It's out when? Next month? Next week?
June 14th.
Oh my God, 2 weeks, June 14th. Real soon, out on Verso. It's fantastic. We've already read it, so haha. But you can read it starting next month. And also pick up Logic Magazine. We'll put a little link to it in the information about the show. And thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Dude, I don't know. You know how you have like a long ass hair sometimes? Like just one hair grows like way longer? Yeah. You know what I'm talking about. I woke up the other day and I had like a no shit, like a 6-inch long chest hair.
What'd you do with it?
I marveled at it. I tried to take a picture of it, but it's hair, so it doesn't show up in the photo. And I was just like, it was seriously like out to like here.
Did you pluck it?
I had to.
Why didn't you leave it?
Because it was weird. It felt like
it could be like your weird hair.
I know. Well, I got another weird, you know about my other weird hair.
But a weird singular hair.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, the other one's singular too. It's just really long and curled. So it looks, gives the appearance
that's
of a lot of hair.
That's your tail.
Oh, man. Remember that guy gave me that tail? Remember that guy? Yeah. All right.
That was so gross.
No, that wasn't. All right. To give context to this. First of all, shout out to the guy, to the listener who gave me a human tail in New York.
It was like attached to a little piece of cardboard.
Yeah.
And well, I was like, what the fuck is that? And you're like, it's a tail. Like as if I would know what that is.
Well, I'm sorry. Yeah, it is. There's only one thing. It's either a tail or a penis and it didn't have a head. So yeah, I wasn't no veins. I've been wearing that thing. I mean, when was that? It was like a year and like 5-6 months ago. So I've been wearing, it's basically been a year and a half. I had that thing on. It's not like a furry thing. There's no hair on it or nothing.
Oh my God.
Well, thank you to Ben for coming on the show.
I hope he didn't listen to this part.
Would you listen to, if you did an interview on a podcast, would you listen to the podcast again?
Probably not.
No.
I'd already know. I'd be like, oh yeah, I remember this. I did that. I said that. I remember doing this.
I'm going to take a leap of faith and guess that they didn't modulate my voice to be higher.
Oh, yeah.
And so,
a little supercut, little edits. Mm-hmm. We don't do that here.
It's bullshit because I feel like
Young Chopsy could modulate our voices to be like James Earl Jones.
Yeah, you didn't know which James Earl to go with. James Earl Ray.
I'm not joking. My shit is, you know how Liz asked 90% of the questions in that interview? Because,
yeah, you got
first of all,
brain.
She's smarter than me. But second of all, I am boy.
Yeah, you got slime ball brain.
I got slime ball brain. It's all just visions of the Mrs. Musinex's fucking hard bod. Because she's got a six pack. It's crazy.
It wouldn't be hard, though, because she's mucus, too.
No. She's in good shape.
She's like got to be a little gelatinous-y because mucus. She's mucus.
Yeah, but it's gelatin. It's gelatin encased muscles. Like actually, I don't know about that. That would be weird. I never fucked around with any real muscly women. That seems weird, man. I don't know about if I would do that.
I think you should keep going.
Yeah, I mean, no, I mean, there's nowhere else to go. I never did, you know. I've been. Let's just say I've taken the "It's a Small World After All" ride, but you know, I don't know if they don't have a gym on that ride. You know what I'm saying?
What? I don't know what you're saying at all.
You feel me?
No.
Am I visibly sweating? Because I'm physically sweating right now.
Yeah, you should be because I have absolutely no clue what you just said, and I'm pretty sure it could be illegal. On that note, I'm Liz.
My name is Brace. And of course, we have producer Young Chomsky and of course, manager of the podcast, the Musinex.
We will see you next time. Hopefully by then, Brace will be back in tip-top shape. But we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.